You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Well, hello, David.
Hi there.
Thanks for joining the Business of Pharmacy podcast. Great to have you on.
Thank you very much for having me.
David, tell our listeners who you are and what's going on hot right now.
My name is David Light. I'm the founder and CEO of an online pharmacy called Valisher. And we're a very unique pharmacy, really the first pharmacy online or not, that is attached to an analytical laboratory. So we actually chemically analyze what's in medications and take samples from every single batch of every single medication that comes through our pharmacy. We screen out those that have problems and then deliver direct to patients medications that come not just with their brand, but also with a certificate of analysis, very much like nutritional information. And, you know, the reality and certainly what's getting a lot more visibility these days is that over 80% of our medications are manufactured in India and China. There's starting to be congressional hearings about this, a lot more visibility about these problems. Certainly a lot of pharmacists, I'm sure, very well aware of all the recalls on Valsartan and Losartan and recently Ranitidine with serious carcinogen problems due to a variety of issues in the supply chain. And our main focus at Valisher is that we actually check. We're actually analyzing what's in those medications and trying to get the highest possible quality medications to our patients and to the industry as a whole. So we're starting to work a lot more with hospitals and healthcare systems to plug in our core value and competency of quality assurance in medication.
I bet the manufacturers never imagined there'd be someone on this side watching. Do you think they knew that?
That's a good question. I think we're all on the same side here. If manufacturers are producing quality products, then everything's great. But I think high level, really one of the issues that's allowed all of these problems to come out is that this is a self-reported industry. Just like you've seen all these, very vividly with the airline industry. The 737 MAX, and hey, when things go wrong with that kind of self-regulated industry, you have a plane explode, and it's extremely visible. But medications, it's harder to see. They all kind of look the same, whether they have carcinogens in them or whether they're not dissolving properly or have the wrong dosage levels. These are all things that we check and we've found problems with. So, again, it's less visible, but the problems have been there a long time, and we're currently rejecting over 10% of the batches that we analyze.
No kidding. Wow. When you say a batch, pharmacists, can they think of that as a lot number? Would that be a batch or?
Exactly. Synonymous. Yes.
Okay. I imagine different manufacturers have different size lots. Is that like usually a day's production? They would name that a lot, or would that be like an hour in every lot number, or is that just across the board?
So it can vary from manufacturer to manufacturer and product to product, but generally they're quite large. So at the manufacturer, they'll usually make millions of pills at a time in one lot. And usually the lot is when they're changing over, starting materials that come in very large quantities.
Gotcha.
Or changing over the machinery. So it tends to be in a very large quantity. And then, of course, it goes, drugs are going to go through 10, 20 different hands by the time they actually get to the pharmacy.
Right.
So the lots could be split up around the world.
Whatever's in the big tank kind of thing, right?
Exactly. And it could take weeks or even longer to make that entire lot.
Wow. If you get medicine in and then later you get the same lot in, let's say a week later, does that have to be tested too, or do you have a way to record that and say, oh, that's lot 1, 2, 3, 4 again, we tested that 2 weeks ago, so we're good?
Actually, the way that we're functioning in our standard business model is actually being buying large lots.
Gotcha.
So we actually, from a business perspective, actually function very differently than a lot of pharmacies.
Yeah.
In the sense that we take a lot of inventories. We'll buy 6 months or sometimes even a year's worth of inventory of certain drugs so that we maintain a large lot
And it's always in your site, and you only have to test it once because it's that same lot.
Exactly. And you know, we've developed a lot of our own proprietary analytics to reduce the costs in some of the most expensive areas of analyzing what's inside of a pill. Yeah. We also use a lot of industry standards, so things like carcinogen analysis. We follow FDA protocols. So we arguably have a really optimized business for the lowest cost but still highest sure. precision analysis, but still costs money, right? So people yeah. ask us all the time, well, how do you make any money doing this? The biggest bottom line is that we're buying these large lots. We add this analysis cost, but it amortizes over a large lot. So it's really
yeah.
you know, pennies or fractions of a penny per pill yeah, of additional
right.
cost.
You're not working like a regular pharmacy where you're buying two bottles and testing this each day kind of thing.
Exactly. And it's a destructive test, right? So the pills yeah. are destroyed.
So you never – everybody gets like – where most people get a 90-day supply, like you'd have to be sending out like 82-day supplies and things like that because you,
right.
you had to use not 8 of the tablets, you know?
Exactly. And you know, it also underscores the point that obviously we don't test every pill.
Yeah.
Because then we'd have no pills.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's essentially how it works.
That's fascinating. All right, let's back up in your life, David. I know you went to Yale. What was your degree there? And when did you start thinking as an 8-year-old or 10 or 12 or 15-year-old that you wanted to go in that direction? So what was your degree at Yale?
So I studied molecular biology, I was always very science-minded and I think entrepreneurial as well. You know, back when I was – I think even in middle school, started an eBay business selling all sorts of scientific trinkets like neodymium iron boron magnets and elemental sodium, definitely been a science nerd my whole life. And I was really interested in chemistry biology as well as I got into college. And molecular biology was kind of the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
I think I always really liked the practical application of this kind of science. So,
right.
you know, having a business around it or really impacting people's lives with it. Obviously nothing wrong in being in academics or just studying it, but I really wanted to see it have the direct practical impact on humanity and on people. And graduating from Yale, actually, I worked primarily in the biotech industry a lot in DNA sequencing. I worked at a company called Ion Torrent, where we kind of had this idea that we would sequence DNA in a microchip. We spent a fair amount of time and money showing that our original concept that was based on an academic paper was nonsense and was just noise. We had a great support and great scientists, and we actually figured out and we had some good backup plans, and it's now the number two DNA sequencing technology in the world.
Wow.
Myself and actually one of the other original founders of Valisher, we were the chemistry department, and we invented a new particle that actually enabled this system to function and at a commercial level. And so I headed chemistry R&D. Kind of developed the whole system around it. We had to invent new manufacturing and QA/QC systems, and everything had to be done from scratch because it was just so different than anything that was on there in the market.
Wow.
But it worked.
Wow. Define particle for me. Is that a combination of more than one different molecule or?
Yeah, so it's like a really tiny grain of sand. We were making these DNA binding particles that were like a micron size, so like the size of a bacteria or so.
Wow.
They were very difficult to work with, but they worked really well. And as all the systems were working and the science had come together and we'd launched and we were the fastest growing sequencing company out there, and we were purchased by Life Technologies and then Thermo Fisher Scientific, and I migrated to a director of product management and more of the business side, and really got an amazing experience at that company. then one day, a good friend of mine from Yale called me up one day and was telling me about all these problems he was having with his anticonvulsant medications. I mean, essentially, he'd refill it every month, and every once in a while, he'd have this month where he just felt terrible and had all these side effects and relapses sometimes. And he'd talk to his doctors, and his doctors would tell him, listen, there's a lot of variability out there, and generics are made all over the world, and mostly in India and China, and there's just nothing much we can do about it as doctors, nothing much your pharmacist can do, and it just kind of is what it is. So he obviously didn't like that answer and called me up, and we started to look into it from a technology perspective. You know, when you're a hammer, all the solutions look like nails, and right. Figured if we just develop a higher throughput, lower cost, but really high accuracy system that we could plug into the end of the supply chain. I think our high level idea was still that we should analyze, in the United States, trust but verify. Like, great that the manufacturers there are analyzing, but when you read books like Bottle of Lies that came out this year by Catherine Eben, I mean, the amount of fraud that can happen in these kinds of self-reported systems is massive. You have companies like Ranbaxy; they're almost entirely just fraudulent products that they never tested anything.
Yeah.
So. Point is, let's actually test here. The FDA does as much inspection as it can, but it's not doing chemical testing very rarely.
Sure.
And so we developed that. So we spent a couple years of our own time and money and effort, and we developed a spectroscopy-based approach. So it's specifically Raman spectroscopy. That essentially enabled us to have all the advantages of lasers, which is really fast and easy and cheap to use, but didn't used to have the accuracy that we needed, but we developed the accuracy components so we can analyze for things like dosage in a very high throughput, interchangeable way.
I, of course, know exactly what you're talking about. but for our listeners, the spectroscopy, you're talking about shining light through something and then seeing how the light distributes and the computer kind of reads that. Is that close?
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Okay.
What you're scanning for or the information that you're getting back is the light changes depending on the molecular structure of what you're looking at. And that's how you can actually, usually use that to identify molecules. Like, is this a malaria medication or is this a sugar pill? And that's generally what these things are used for. But for us to be able to tell, well, is this, 80 milligrams of atorvastatin or is this actually 72, or 97, that kind of quantitative analysis wasn't really possible. And so that's we developed it. We filed the patents on it. We got ISO accreditation. So the International Organization for Standardization accredited not just our lab, but also the core technology. And we were very proud of ourselves. And we started talking to the big players in the industry, pharmacies and distributors and the folks that from a biotech background, that's kind of where you go and license mm-hmm. and kind of plug these things in.
Yeah.
And everybody basically told us the same thing, which was, yeah, we know there's problems in the system and it looks like the problems are even getting worse, but it's not our problem. So we got ISO certification. Accreditation, actually, not just our laboratory, but also the core technology itself. So really showing that very robust. And we were very proud of ourselves. And we went and start talking to the industry, the big players in the field, the pharmacies and distributors. And everybody kind of told us the same thing when we approached them about adding quality assurance, at the end of the supply chain, which was... We know there's problems out there and quality issues are certainly seem to be getting worse, but it's not our problem. It's always somebody else's problem. This is a $2 trillion global supply chain, and there's always somebody else to point the finger at.
Of course.
And kind of nobody wanted to take any additional responsibility.
Yeah.
And so at that point, and this is now starting into 2018, We decided that online pharmacy seems to be a big up-and-coming area, of course. And,
right.
You know, more recently, Amazon bought PillPack, and obviously a lot of movement in that space.
Yeah.
And so we said, A, that seems like a very interesting business to get into, but also, B, this would allow us to actually bring our core value of this quality assurance and medication just direct to the patients.
Right.
And we were hearing, you know, more and more, and especially after we launched, we heard not just from patients, but also from doctors, you know, about their patients that complain all the time about generics, having variability issues, not trusting their generics, and then the doctors are worried about adherence. And they were basically the ones that taught us that we kind of created this new category of medication of a validated generic.
Yeah. You
know, you've had brand, which, you know, a lot of people can't afford but trust. And now there's, you know, generics, which are over 90% that people can afford but, you know, more and more don't trust.
Right.
But now that you have this validated generic where we've chemically analyzed samples from every single batch, comes with these certificates of analysis, you know, very, you wouldn't buy food without nutritional information on it.
Right.
But yet your meds come in an orange bottle and says 10 milligrams, and that's all you really know about it.
Yeah.
So that's and that's how we got to Valisure. And I think the other thing, after launching, not only did we start hearing a lot from doctors, we started to hear a lot from hospitals, from healthcare systems that are really kind of directly connected to the patients. And, you know, concerned about the operations themselves, you know, having to deal with these huge recalls and all of these problems.
Yeah.
And also, obviously, being very concerned about the patients. You know, the fact that you're hearing more and more from, you know, key opinion leaders at the Cleveland Clinic that they're having problems with, you know, medications for heart transplants and, you know, really important things.
Right.
That seem to have a lot of variability and not doesn't seem like anybody's really doing that much about it.
Right.
So we were really engaged to do something, you know, not just add more visibility,
right,
but actually offer a solution where we're really all we're doing is trying to help ensure quality by chemically testing and screening out those that have issues. And, you know, it was when we added carcinogen analysis earlier this year because of all these valsartan, losartan recalls, that we started to see real problems there that weren't being caught. We found a fourth major carcinogen in valsartan and did an FDA citizen petition earlier in the summer. And then we saw all these problems with ranitidine and Zantac and all the brand or generic products.
Yeah.
That's obviously caught a lot of news recently.
For our listeners, just a little bit of the history of how things would work in the pharmacy. You know, let's say a Mrs. Smith would come in, and back in the day with insurances, this is going back to the early 80s, we could tell them, we'd say, well, this drug is for epilepsy or it's for your heartbeat or something. So the brand name is not necessarily better than the generic, but it's probably more consistent. So stay on that and you'll probably get more consistency there. However, as the insurances then stop covering the brand names, now you're going to the generics. And then we would tell people, well, at least stay on the same generic company. It might be more potent or less potent than the brand name drug, but at least it's going to be consistent. But now with the PBMs, the insurances really pressing on pricing, every pharmacy is really forced to buy the hopefully quality but least expensive drug. And so now, even if a drug was chemically pure, it's all over the map on even just the percentage of the drug that has to be in the medicine, not to mention all the things that David just said about the carcinogens and every other thing that could be in there. 2 or 3 years ago, I was really amazed when I looked up about drugs and it said, if you have a drug that has so many milligrams, it's allowed to be so many percent below that of the drug and so many percent above that of the drug.
Yeah.
I was really floored by that range of how even a certified drug, the FDA is saying, it's, you know, if it's 100 milligrams, it can be 95 or 107 or something like that. And that still passes. Can you comment on that?
Sure.
Are you guys looking at actual strength then too?
You know, if you go into a Home Depot and you buy a plastic 6-foot table, they'll say on the label there that that's plus or minus 1%.
Yeah.
But most drugs are allowed to be plus or minus 10%.
10%. That's fascinating.
Right.
In a bad way to me.
And the reality is that you could have, and we've looked at this, you know, you'll have one manufacturer that's low in that range, and then you have another manufacturer that's high in the range. So it's really a 20% variability that's possible if they're following all the rules.
Yeah.
Right? And then obviously not everybody follows all the rules. We've found drugs, even really important narrow therapeutic index drugs like levothyroxine, thyroid medication, that's failed the standard specs and are outside of it. And by the way, once you add also dissolution, so how the pill dissolves in your body and gets into the bloodstream, that's allowed to vary 45%.
Oh my gosh.
From one manufacturer to the next. So it can be minus 20 to plus 25 in blood levels.
After dissolution.
Right.
Wow. And are you finding that the same manufacturer from lot to lot has different percentages, or are those usually pretty close? Like, let's say it's 92 milligrams instead of 100. Is that consistent? Or are you finding that even from the same manufacturer that maybe the next time it's 103 milligrams?
It's really hard to tell because honestly, so sometimes, yeah, you see a manufacturer at least stay relatively in the same, ballpark.
Uh-huh.
And then you'll see it sometimes. We also do inactive ingredient scans.
Yeah.
And we'll see that the sourcing of the material must have entirely changed. And it could be from entirely different factories, right? The same product can be made in a variety of different places under the same manufacturer. So really to do it right, it has to be done batch by batch. Things that are very straightforward, like carcinogen levels, when we did our deep analysis of valsartan, and we looked not just at the, NDMA, nitrosodimethylamine, which has been one of the key big carcinogen problems. But NDMA, it's largely theorized, has in the case of valsartan, was made by the switch to the solvent called DMF, dimethylformamide, which itself is a carcinogen, and actually a group 2 carcinogen, the same level of probably carcinogenic to humans that NDMA is. And so we said, you know what, let's be proactive and look for that too. And we found it in about 2/3 of all the batches we analyzed. We found this carcinogen, including in the brand.
Wow.
The brand was lower than some of the generics that were much higher that we analyzed. Point is, you really got to check everything. You know, brand is not a guarantee of absolute quality. Zantac as well. We looked at the Zantac. We looked at the generics, and we found problems all around. But point was that when we looked at this deep dive in valsartan, there are some manufacturers that were totally clean and were great. And then we tested another batch or even just a combination product of valsartan, like hydrochlorothiazide. And then it failed completely. Like, it had really high levels of the dimethylformamide and even NDMA. We found a batch that was failing even the FDA spec on the known and well-studied carcinogen.
That's fascinating. Let me use the drug strength as the example again. Let's say your limit is 10%, but you find it at 8% off. Do you then pass that along to the consumer, or do you just have basically a green light, red light kind of thing? Because even as a pharmacist, if you sent something to me and said, this is supposed to be 100 milligrams, but it's 92 milligrams and it's okay, I would say, wait a minute, you guys didn't do your job, even though you did, because the FDA allows that. How do you go about that? Are you just saying, yes, this is okay? You're not giving all the data, I imagine?
Also, we're not trying to scare people or make them uncomfortable with their medications. And I think you're right that Probably the average American consumer is assuming that when it says 100 milligrams, it's 100.000 milligrams.
Right, yeah.
And you know, to be fair, and coming from the sciences and
sure.
you know, manufacturing of biotech device world,
yeah.
It's never going to be perfect.
No, right.
And, you know, we would love for the FDA and the USP to get tighter,
yeah.
Especially in certain products where it really...
Where it matters,
it's obvious
more, yeah.
that it makes a difference,
right?
But you know, ultimately, we are kind of it's either red or it's green. We do try and find manufacturers that are also more as consistent as we can get. But we don't make drugs, right? At
right.
Voucher, so we're beholden to whatever's out there, and obviously we. People need their meds.
Yeah.
So, you know, if things are failing, we don't care. We've had situations where we just weren't able to find a particular med that was passing. But usually we do.
Yeah.
And we make sure that it's at the very least within the prescribed, you know, United States pharmacopoeia bounds, you know,
sure.
the monographs or the FDA standards.
They might say this drug is allowed to have so much of not just the chemical strength, but so much of X, but no more than X, whether that's the filler or whatever, and you're making sure that it's in those ranges.
Right, exactly. And like Disillusion, you know, they might say extend release, but when you actually look at the monographs, they might say between 12 and 15 hours or,
right.
You know, or sometimes even, you know, more broad than that or... You know, we follow and make sure that they're at least following that. And actually, on the subject of the pill coming apart, one thing that we do, you know, as scientists is we do make sure to test medications in conditions that are kind of real world conditions.
Right.
So actually looking at conditions of what would be in your stomach, what would be in your intestinal fluid.
Right.
And there are industry standards around this and academic standards. But unfortunately, some of the problems that we see a fair amount in Disillusion is that the drug companies themselves are allowed to register whatever rules they want in how to even analyze for a drug dissolving.
Yeah.
And which is very odd
yeah.
To us. And usually they're reasonable tests. But there are situations, like, for example, with lamotrigine that we've done a deeper study on, and there's a number of these drugs that we really delve into, where the USP registered monograph for how, you know, for essentially the way this works is you have a beaker with solution that is similar to your stomach, like a, you know, acidic pH, and
sure.
then when it goes into intestine.
With me, you'd have a lot of ice cream and pecans and things like that in there too.
That's part of the reality of doing a lab test is you can't perfectly recreate the pecans
and the hot dogs
and those kinds of things. But, you know, at the very least, you have the major products and the right pH.
Sure.
And so usually you start at a pH of 1.2 or 2 for the stomach, which is a very acidic pH. And then the intestine is usually about a pH of 6.8. And you know, reasonable salt concentrations,
mm-hmm.
and you basically have a pill and a paddle in there, and a paddle kind of spins around,
sure,
and you measure samples from this beaker over time to see how the pill is dissolving and the drug
yeah.
is getting into the solution. So
yeah.
that's kind of how it works. All the conditions in that beaker can actually be determined by the drug companies who develop the drug, and so you have situations like lamotrigine, which is a really important anticonvulsant,
yeah.
anti-epileptic drug. Also an antidepressant. The solution is supposed to be a pH of 12, which drain cleaner is a pH of 11.
Mm.
So this is like super extra strength drain cleaner
yeah.
pH-wise. And there's enough ionic surfactant or soap in there to kill 5 rats.
Wow.
So you know, you have this solution that dissolves the pill very well. It could also dissolve your hand.
Yeah, right.
But it's... at least in our view, not a very good metric for how it would actually dissolve in your body.
Yeah, right. It's like if a pill had to be, whatever, crushed somehow or something, and they say, well, we ran over it with a tank. It's like, well, yeah, but we need to, right. we need it to be chewable or something like that.
Precisely. In our laboratory, we follow these standard, you know, industry standards of what a human stomach would be, what a human intestines would be.
Yeah.
And, you know, in some of these cases, when we test it in these real world conditions, you get very different results.
Right.
And we oftentimes screen out products that way as well. So, you know, they may not have, you know, the red-green you talked about,
yeah.
Maybe that would have been a green,
yeah.
If you would have, you know, essentially tested it in drain cleaner.
Yeah.
But when we test it in physiologically relevant and in real-world conditions and we get a red,
yeah.
We still screen that out.
I was listening to an interview that you were on, and in fact, you've got like what you would say is a 100-point inspection. You're testing a ton of stuff on every medicine, right?
Exactly. We test multiple different carcinogens, and you know, different medications have different tests that they get.
It yeah.
Obviously, wouldn't make much sense to do dissolution analysis on eye drops.
Sure. Right. Right.
And we have a lot of our core products, you know, high volume products that we do really deep analysis on. But you know, certain analyses like dosage, like dissolution, are really calibrated to the drug itself.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, with a lot of our proprietary technology, we can do these kinds of calibrations in a day or two, but still takes a whole day of calibrating just to that drug.
Mm.
So we're slower in adding more and more drugs, and we have about 100 drug products or so that we do the very deep analysis on. Other analyses like carcinogens analysis, we have to calibrate for the carcinogens.
Yeah.
So we have about 7 carcinogens right now that we analyze for every batch of every medication. But that we don't have to tailor to the actual drug.
Gotcha.
So we have over 2,000 drug products that we can at the very least, you know, have this safety screen of analyzing for those carcinogens. And that's how we found the problems with Zantac and ranitidine.
Carcinogens. I'm imagining there's millions of carcinogens. And if you guys are doing 7, you're doing the ones that somehow seem to sneak their way into manufacturing plants. It's either the metal that a lot of these plants use or some other thing. Is that correct?
No, you're right. There are, you know, at the very least thousands of known carcinogens, and it would be almost impossible to actually analyze for every single possible thing that could go wrong
yeah.
in the medication. And you know, we want to be very transparent about that. You know, when
sure.
you have medication for us, it's not an absolute guarantee that everything
right.
possible was ever checked. A lot more than zero.
Yeah, yeah.
and the point is that you can be smart about these things. You can
sure.
take educated guesses about what to look for, what are bigger problems, what are kind of known manufacturing problems.
Yeah, right.
You know, specifically these nitrosamine carcinogens, so NDMA, NDEA, that you start to hear a lot about.
Yeah.
The blood pressure meds, the problem with Zantac and ranitidine was NDMA again. This class of carcinogen called nitrosamines has been well studied since the 1950s.
Yeah.
It's one of the most potent carcinogens on the planet and one of the best studied ones there are.
Yeah.
And, you know, people sometimes get hung up on the concept that it's described as a probable human carcinogen. Doesn't that mean that it's not so bad? But the only reason that it's a probable human carcinogen is you can't have a study where you actually give people a carcinogen and then try and see what kind of cancers
yeah,
they
right,
get.
Yeah, right,
right. Obviously, that would not be an ethical study to have.
Right.
So they do the studies on animals. And in the animals, it's extremely clear.
Yeah.
You know, NDMA is actually used as a control to induce cancer in clinical studies on rats. You know, if you want to be sure that a rat is going to get cancer,
you do that.
You give it NDMA.
Is the NDMA in hot dogs?
So there is NDMA at very low levels in a variety of places.
Is that the place where you'll see, like, if something says no nitrates, like on the front of a hot dog thing, are nitrates NDMA or is that too broad of a brush?
Now, that's actually it touches on a really important point, is nitrates or also nitrites.
Nitrites,
if you look at a hot dog package,
yeah.
A lot of them, if you look at the ingredients, you'll see sodium nitrite.
Right, right.
And it's an additive. they put in there.
It's for flavor and coloring and to make it taste better and longer life and all that stuff.
Right. A really important point related to Zantac and ranitidine, and this has been discussed, is that there's actually about 50 years, five decades of research that are looking at nitrites in your stomach that react with certain drugs.
Hmm.
This has, you know, been a really big area of academic research, in, you know, paper, you know, journals like Nature and The Lancet and, you know, really serious, you know, big scientific publications.
Yeah.
for decades. And actually in 1979, there was a drug called methapyrolene that was a histamine blocker, an over-the-counter drug. It had an unstable DMA group, a dimethylamine group, on the molecule itself that was suspected through a lot of studies to react with nitrite.
Gotcha.
In your stomach.
Gotcha.
And then form NDMA. So nitrite is like the N, right? It's the N of the NDMA.
I see.
And so you could have the DMA on the drug, and then if you're eating nitrite...
I gotcha.
Then those two can combine and form NDMA.
I gotcha.
In your stomach. This was the reason all this carcinogen worries caused this drug methapyrolene to be recalled. And that drug was out for 25 years. It was over the counter.
I see.
You know, the FDA, the National Cancer Institute, and all over the world and industry recalled this drug because of very similar problems of exactly what's happening in ranitidine.
I see.
And ranitidine, or which is the active ingredient of Zantac, has not just a DMA on the molecule, which can react with nitrite in your stomach.
Yeah.
It also has a nitrite. It has an N on the molecule as well.
Oh, I see. Gotcha.
And a lot of the initial data that we looked at that we put in our FDA citizen petition was that at you know, standard analysis temperatures, which are higher than body temperature,
yeah,
but these are really standard for analysis in the laboratory, the drug was actually reacting with itself.
Wow.
So it was able to, you know, certainly in the stomach is concerning.
Right.
But the fact that the molecule is so unstable,
yeah,
that it can react with itself within minutes.
Right.
And form, you know, not just, you know, low levels of NDMA, but millions and millions of nanograms. So the FDA limit for NDMA is 96 nanograms per day.
Okay.
And we were detecting millions in the detectors.
The hot dog itself, they even call some of the hot dogs carcinogens, but not because of the nitrites necessarily.
Yeah. So also important to differentiate that there are, you know, cured meats, even in very low levels in water sometimes, you can find NDMA, the carcinogen itself. So nitrite by itself is not necessarily carcinogenic, but when it combines with the NDMA...
Or the DMA.
When it combines with the DMA...
That's the last time I'm going to correct you.
Excuse me. Sorry.
Do I have to do everything around here, David?
I'm glad you're listening. So by the way, this is actually a pretty relevant and important, you know, getting down into the weeds here.
Yeah.
Because there's statements that came from the FDA recently about analyzing stomach conditions, and they claimed that they didn't find any NDMA being formed with ranitidine and Zantac products. But it seems that they didn't add any nitrite. So they just had acid and salt, you know, the simulated gastric fluid standard, which especially in this case is just not a representation of a real world stomach.
Would you have to add it though? Because the ranitidine, if it already has the N there, would you have to add it? Or when you do add it, it even does it more?
So certainly when you add it, it does it more.
Gotcha.
When you have just the free nitrite.
Gotcha.
And that's what we saw as well.
I see.
Is that when you're in the very simplistic stomach condition, so you can't just like you said before, like we can't test with pecans in there and hot dogs and everything else. And we don't know what you're going to eat versus your neighbor.
But nitrites are in everything. And so you always have it in the stomach usually.
And even if you didn't eat anything with nitrite in it, you're going to have nitrite in your stomach. It's always present in your stomach. It's always present in your blood. Nitrite is also getting manufactured in your body by bacteria in your saliva.
Oh,
by bacteria. And ironically, when you take an antacid, it's often because you've eaten foods particularly high in nitrite, right?
Yeah, you've had your pepperoni pizza and that kind of stuff.
Hot dogs and everything else.
Yeah.
And the act, it's also very well known in the scientific literature that the act of taking an antacid dramatically increases the growth of bacteria that form nitrite.
No kidding. Isn't that something?
Like we can argue all day about what is the appropriate amount of nitrite that we should be testing.
Right.
Our levels that we used was very similar to a recent clinical study at Stanford University, which is actually also very similar to what the World Health Organization actually suggested back in their global summit on nitrates and nitrosamines in 1978. Okay. But you know, we can debate what the right levels are, but they're definitely not zero.
Yeah, right.
They're absolutely not zero for practically anyone. And and we did show the tests even in our own citizen petition where if you don't have any nitrites, it's very difficult to detect the NDMA formation. And we didn't detect any in the stomach conditions. You might still be forming it in the body, and you might still be forming it by enzymes that are in your stomach and everything else, which are almost impossible to replicate. But you have to put some nitrite in there in order to test it properly.
They're creating their own false condition.
Yeah. So at the very least, these are very different conditions than what's been used for 50 years by academic researchers. So we still very much believe that the NDMA carcinogen is being formed in the human stomach at alarmingly high levels with any ranitidine. So whether it's Zantac or any other manufacturer, generic or and it doesn't matter if it's in a pill or a syrup or any form, we think there's a very high danger of this forming high levels of NDMA in your stomach and potentially even higher levels of NDMA once it goes out of your stomach throughout your body. I mean, you have these enzymes that are these micro reactors, these chemical reactors throughout your body. You have thousands and thousands of different kinds of these. And when you have a molecule that's just so inherently unstable, that it could even be reacting with itself, let alone anything else in your body.
With the NDMA reacting right with itself.
Exactly. And it's not just that it's degrading, it's reacting and then directly forming one of the most potent carcinogens on the planet.
We're not just chasing down anything here. I think you said that if you have a rat that you need to get cancer because you have to study something else, how whatever the cancer does to them, you're giving NDMA. Was that right?
That's correct.
Fascinating.
It's used in clinical studies to induce cancer in rats.
It's like if we want that rat to get cancer, we're not going to have them puff on a cigarette. We're not going to have them, eat
a bunch of bacon
or hot dogs. We're going to give them NDMA to make sure they get cancer, or else we're all going to get fired because the rats don't get cancer.
Right. And you're going to have a weak study because you need a control where you know the rat's going to get cancer.
Theranos, certainly that whole story. I don't think that was the subject of the book you mentioned earlier. Theranos was certainly...
definitely an example of fraud.
An example of fraud. How do you get across that you guys aren't Theranos?
Yeah, and obviously very aware of Theranos and all the terrible and deceptive things that they did. And I do want to clarify that the book that I mentioned, Bottle of Lies by Catherine Eben, that's about the fraud in the generic drug industry.
Gotcha.
And making up analytical reports and things like
thank
that. You. Kind of similar to Theranos, actually. Point is that we differentiate ourselves in many ways from that. Even our proprietary technology It wasn't just us saying that it works. We voluntarily brought the International Organization for Standardization.
You're inviting them to breathe down your neck.
Exactly, which is days of audits.
Yeah, right.
And going through all the details, not just of the laboratory system, but the analysis itself and how robust and consistent it is.
Right.
And then on top of that, as we add more and more tests to what we do, we also use industry standard. You know, the tests that we analyzed ranitidine with was the FDA standard at the time.
Yeah.
And a standard technology. So gas chromatography, mass spectrometry has been around for decades.
Yeah, right. Gotcha.
And we're also ISO accredited, the International Organization for Standardization, on those particular tests as well. Like we really know how to run those.
Right.
And I think lastly, you know, the fact that what we're doing is getting so much impact and recognition.
Right.
We're obviously having some scientific debate with the FDA over conditions and things like that. But the bottom line is that there's recalls now all over the world, and they've confirmed that NDMA is there and it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And again, like, you know, we feel that this is a much more serious problem of inherent instability of the drug.
Yeah, exactly.
And that all lots are affected.
Exactly.
And we're still debating that, obviously, but look, you have 4 days after the FDA's statement, you had Health Canada come out.
Right.
And ban ranitidine altogether.
Yeah.
Right? Throughout Canada, it was just banned. And they said in the second line of their statement, they said, current evidence suggests that NDMA may be present in ranitidine regardless of the manufacturer.
Wow.
As in, it's an inherent problem.
Yeah.
And then about 40 other countries followed. All right, so, you know, Germany, France, Italy, Saudi Arabia, you know, Pakistan
wow.
not only banned ranitidine entirely, they also banned the manufacturing of ranitidine in Pakistan. Taiwan instituted fines for any pharmacy that still has ranitidine products on their shelves. You know, Korea released some of their data, and they were finding over 300 times the permissible levels
wow.
of NDMA just as a contamination, not even in the body. You know, we're very concerned about even higher levels in the body.
Wow.
But long story short, to answer your question, I think the validity of the science that we do and its importance are being borne out by many organizations that are serious organizations and regulators now all over the world.
You're not just going to put on a black turtleneck and lower your voice to show your to show your authority,
correct.
Right?
Yeah, I threw away all the turtlenecks.
Do you guys come across any just counterfeits?
You know, we do an inactive ingredient scan as well, where we at least theorize that we might find counterfeits. Because, I mean, a counterfeit could have the right drug in there, right? We're looking for the drug.
Yeah.
We're looking for, you know, carcinogens. Maybe they made it cleanly. But it's very likely that the inactive ingredients, which tend to be proprietary formulations, would be done wrong. And so we also scan for the inactive ingredients. And we have found actually products where the inactive ingredients were incorrect. Now, could that have been a manufacturer mistake? Possibly. Or it could have been a counterfeit.
Have you found any where just the drug itself is not in there?
We have found before where the drug component was wrong.
Wrong. Just the wrong drug, like maybe a mix-up.
Right. Or like actually what we specifically found was the salts were wrong.
Gotcha.
Right? So you might have a drug that's a hydrochloride.
Yeah.
And then in reality it was hydrobromide.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you could have a succinate, like, you know, metoprolol succinate versus tartrate.
Yeah.
You know, and so we have found instances where the counter ion, the salt, was wrong.
Yeah. And for our listeners, the ones you mentioned have a lot to do with how long it's going to be released in the body.
Correct.
So if you've got a heart medicine and you think it's going to release over 24 hours, but it releases over 2 hours, you've got some potential issues there.
Exactly. And those are technically different products, right? The
yeah.
The counter ion, the other half of the drug is part of the overall drug's function many times.
Yeah. About 5 years ago, we actually had a counterfeit drug. One of the pharmacists, well, we never had the drug tested, but one of the pharmacists called me and said, I opened up this bottle of this drug and it was the wrong color tablet and the wrong milligram. We looked at some other sealed bottles and they were actually the different strength in there. And my guess is they were counterfeit, and the FBI and so on got involved. And that was about the last we heard of it, but they're out there, you know?
Yeah. No, absolutely. And there's been a lot of attention to counterfeits in you know, a number of years now in the media, and you know, the World Health Organization is quite concerned about it. But I think one of the things that we've really been seeing is that just because it's authentic doesn't mean it's good either. You know, these all the ranitidine tablets are authentically made and you know, made in the right factories.
Right.
But you know, sometimes these factories have very serious problems, like the all these issues with valsartan and losartan and herbsartan are really due to just poor manufacturing practices. You know, Zantac and ranitidine seems to be a totally different problem of the drug itself. But point is, this all boils down to the same need for additional quality assurance here in the United States, independent testing, you know, testing that isn't part of the standard regulatory pharma world.
Right.
Which I'd like to think does as good of a job as it can, and you know, is just trying to produce high quality products. But
right.
Look, everybody makes mistakes.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt that there's also some bad actors there. Especially with so much manufacturing being overseas. That really we need to be testing here in the United States independently, and chemical testing on every batch.
Is the NDMA the tip of the iceberg for all kinds of stuff that's going to start coming out, or is ranitidine like a special focus, or is this like a cascade of now all kinds of stuff like this?
I mean, you don't know what you don't know,
right.
But I will say that we're a small company. You know, we just launched this thing a year ago, and we're just tripping over these problems, we're finding more issues than we have resources to fully investigate. And you know, we don't release these studies, you know, publicly until we have a lot of the data. You know, we know the impact. We don't want to scare people for no reason.
Right.
And we want to make sure that the science is done absolutely, you know, that we have super high confidence in what we release. And, you know, repeat the studies, have external folks repeat them, and that
right.
kind of thing. And I can definitely say that it's a lot of issues out there, some bigger than others. And I would predict that this is not the last that we're
going to see. All right, David, here is the big question that's been building up inside of me through the interview here.
Sure.
There's this problem out there, and you guys have found a great solution for it. Other people can do things like put the medicine in a bottle and put stamps on the packages and things like that. I'd imagine at some point, and I'm sure a million times it's been through your head, that your company becomes the good housekeeping seal of approval, and you're making money on that through all the pharmacies who everybody says, well, I'm not going to use that if there's not the Valisure seal of approval on it. When do you, or do you at some point switch that where you're the approval the world is looking for versus a drug from you going somewhere?
It's an excellent question, and I think the you know, high level, what we're really interested in and what we're really good at is that quality assurance.
Of course.
Right? And plugging that in to other pharmacies, to other healthcare systems, and that could be through a variety of different ways. You know, maybe that's, you know, wholesale and a few key drugs for now. Or you know, a lot of hospitals have talked to us about, you know, access to the data. You know, all the data and what we're rejecting and why.
Yeah, because they might say, well, you know, this rejects so many percent of the time. Hey, let's just stay away from it. We can buy it from company A. Why go with B that David has found a problem a lot of the times?
Right. And look, they don't want that on their shelves either. Right.
Yeah. Right. Right.
And so, you know, we're working with a number of new partners and experts yeah. in these fields, you know, data scientists, and you know, how can we get as much as possible the core value of what we do?
Yes.
To plug into others, and you know, maybe
yes.
one day, you know, what you describe might really be possible is to plug this into manufacturers and distributors and. Just really have this done consistently. But until we get there, and there's a lot of hurdles to doing that, right? And I think
yeah.
and I think well, part of the difficulty here is that we're finding is that you really have to do this batch by batch. You know, maybe we can
yeah,
aggregate
right.
some of the data
yeah.
And get a good feel for areas to avoid or to improve.
Yeah, but it's batch by batch.
It really needs to be batch by batch. So, you know, we still feel that our primary pharmacy component is really important for what we do in general. However, at the same time, getting as much of that value as we can to others,
yeah.
You know, perhaps through a few key drugs or perhaps through data where we maybe add some quality scores. You know, that the FDA has actually made an announcement where they want to have scores, different scores for different manufacturers.
Oh, right.
Based on their quality system maturity.
Yeah.
So essentially, how much paperwork they've done,
right.
and how long they've been, you know, part of these quality management systems. We're not interested in a lot of paperwork just for the sake of paperwork.
No. Yeah.
You know, we think that you have to chemically analyze it.
People can have a stack of paper, but if it's not looking for the right stuff,
exactly.
or like we talked about the other company, if it's
exactly.
not using the right landscape of what your body really is.
The right condition.
The right condition. If it's not testing that, it's not really passing it then.
Right, exactly. So I think we can start aggregating this into quality scores and you know
yeah.
things like that. And we're very interested in working with hospitals, with healthcare systems.
Yeah, kind of a consumer reports kind of thing almost.
Right, right. So I think that there's many ways that we can start to really infuse the grander value of the quality assurance that we do into the system to touch more patients and get closer to this grand vision of everything is tested. Independently.
Yeah. If I may be my own devil's advocate to my devil's advocate, I would imagine too that part of the value you guys have is once you've captured a lot, you've tested it, you have your eyes on it. Now it hasn't gone out to another wholesaler who could switch something or have it on a shelf too long, you know, whatever. I mean, it's like
right.
when you test something, when you give it your approval, the next step is the customer. It's not another 8 steps going through possible fraud things and all that kind of stuff. That's number one. And number two is, I guess, that one thing you can prove through all this is your proof of concept, I guess, of what the desire or demand is for your prescriptions.
Right. And your first point there touches on, I think, an excerpt that when we were first starting to talk about this 100-point inspection concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's a lot of parallels between, you know, the medication you're going to pick up at a pharmacy to a used car, right? I mean,
yeah.
the reality is that it's touched 10, 20 different hands. It's got thousands
yeah.
of miles on it. It's been all over the world.
Right. yeah.
It's probably a few years old.
Yeah, right.
And so really, you're buying a used car.
But then they say just granny had it in her garage for 15 years.
Right. If you're buying a used car, you're not going to be like, oh, well, you know, the Volkswagen tested it in the plant somewhere, right?
Yeah.
You want a 100-point inspection on that car that you're going to be buying.
Yeah, right.
And that really speaks to your point of you have to test it before the consumer is going to get it or shortly before, which is at the end of this whole supply chain.
Yeah.
Which is not an easy thing to do, and obviously adds a lot of, you know, the stress on the pharmacy. You know, we have a lot of work that we do in our own pharmacy.
Yeah, I imagine.
You know, the bottom line is that we are working towards systems and efficiencies to plug this in and make it as easy as possible for other pharmacists or other healthcare practitioners to be able to use this value.
Yeah. But like you say, with the car analogy, that's absolutely right. Because if you were to test it not until the end, then it's like testing a car out, but then giving it to a teenager to drive around for 2 years and never put oil in it and have the engine burn out. I'm not, not that I'm angry at my kids for any of that.
never happened, I'm sure.
Never happened. But yeah, you got to be close to that end product or else your value has lost its approval if you have other hands, you know, touching it in the final process of things.
Exactly. And that's why it has to be really towards the end of the chain, you know, at the buy time for that patient, for that customer, and batch to batch. You know, it's like just because, you know, this one model of car worked out well for you doesn't mean that everything else that manufacturer's ever made is perfect.
Yeah. Oh, I thought another way to be a devil's advocate.
Perfect.
All right. Here we go. You guys being mail order to people, you hear about it's in the heat of the postal truck for the day or it's 23 degrees in the mailbox for 2 hours before the customer gets it. Do you guys have anything like that to refute those claims that a typical brick and mortar pharmacy would use against mail order?
It is an important point, and we are aware and concerned about it. And I think one of the important differentiations and also what we decide to ship or not is we don't do cold chain shipping. So, you know, drugs that are classified as being unstable or as needing very tight tolerances or you know, these very specific temperatures, we don't have on our formulary.
Gotcha.
And honestly, you know, some of these drugs like ranitidine that were not classified that way, but you know, we discovered were very unstable.
Heat or cold could do some of those.
Exactly. You know, a hot car could have very easily led to, you know, ranitidine reacting with itself.
I never use those excuses. I don't know if I believed them or if it was just brick and mortar pharmacists using it as a way to try to scare people a little bit. But I guess, like you say, sometimes the heat, you know, can do some things to that.
Right. And look, there is, you know, as obviously you know, in pharmacy, there is a differentiation between drugs you have to keep in a fridge.
Yeah, right.
Versus one that could sit on the shelf.
Right.
Look, these shipping companies are supposed to adhere to their own standards as well.
Yeah, right.
You know, we are definitely aware of it, and that's a big reason why we don't do some of these really sensitive drugs through mail order. We not only do obviously the standard shipping that any other mail order pharmacy does, but unlike any other pharmacies, we actually are doing kind of inadvertently some of the stability testing.
Yeah, exactly.
Through carcinogen analysis and others. Certainly at least once have found a serious concern.
Yeah.
You know, on the ranitidine side.
Yeah. David, if someone said to you that you're no longer allowed to do drugs, you can't take this road anymore, are there other holes in the marketplace that can use testing like this in your mind? Like if someone said,
absolutely,
no more drugs, we can't do that. What other areas could your business do if it had to?
Certainly. You know, we get asked a lot about supplements. I mean, obviously we do supplements in our pharmacy
okay.
as well.
Sure.
We get asked a lot about, you know, CBD and marijuana. I think this whole area has really big hole in regulation over it.
Sure.
You know, for a lot of reasons. And you have, you know, various states doing different things, and obviously the federal government still very much anti most of that field. So at Valisher, we take very seriously playing, you know, very much outside of any gray areas. You know, we dot our I's and cross our T's and everything we do, you know, legally. And so and we have DEA licenses, you know, so we don't participate in that field now, you know, eventually one day, hopefully it'll be legalized and then we can get into that. But I think even beyond that, you know, there's a report recently about heavy metals in baby food.
Interesting. Right. Food. Yeah.
Baby products in general. There's a lot of concern over heavy metals in the plastics, BPA in plastic.
Something that kids might be munching on or in contact with or something like that. So not even internal stuff, right?
No, exactly. You know, hey, I got four kids and they go through a lot of toys and I don't know where they're all from and I don't know how well they were made.
Right.
And we go through a lot of baby food and formula and all those kinds of things.
Exactly.
So definitely think there's a lot of areas for expansion of the core value of independent analysis at the end of the supply chain.
That's right. What's your least favorite part of your day in your last couple years? Like, what day do you wake up and say, crap, it's Wednesday, I got to do this week? Do you have something you don't like?
You know, being so steeped in the healthcare system now, which was, I was an outsider, right? We were biotech scientists.
Right.
Even in the business of science is, you know, very different than, you know, the ins and outs of healthcare.
Right.
I have to admit, the complexity and convoluted nature of this system is something that I definitely do not like.
The financial part or the FDA drug part?
No, I'd say the nuances of getting a patient a prescription, going through PBMs.
Oh, jeez.
You know?
You just made me want to go have a bowl of ice cream now.
And so with some pecans.
Yeah.
At least try and avoid the nitrites.
Yeah, right.
I had no idea what a PBM was before getting into this business. Oh. And, you know, the fact that they exist and that there's these massive multi-billion dollar organizations that, you know, we as, you know, a pharmacy have to contract with, but then are directly competing against.
Yeah.
At the same time, like, I don't even understand how that's legal.
Well, David, that's why I said I was devil's advocate. I was actually being a friend. I was trying to say, leave, go. You know what I mean? It's tough.
Thanks.
It's tough.
It is tough. But you know what? I think that's also where there's tremendous opportunity.
Absolutely.
And it's a system that, you know, when you, especially when you talk to professionals, but even more and more now, just individual average patients, you know, everybody agrees healthcare is broken.
You're bringing trust into a industry that inherently nobody trusts anybody anymore. You found that hole.
I didn't even realize that, right?
Yeah, you didn't even realize that.
And I think you're right. Is one of our core values of transparency, and you know, quality through the transparency of what we do.
Yeah.
We knew that it was needed.
Yeah.
You know, when starting Valisher, but
right.
I don't think we fully grasped just how needed it is, how difficult it would be to really infuse it into the system.
Exactly.
How many barriers there are to really innovating and changing this system.
Right.
There is a growing wave of momentum here that the system needs to change.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Right? Like, obviously, quality assurance and medication is what we're focused on, but there's been a lot of talk about PBMs and all the problems there, about drug pricing in general, about drug reimportation from other countries.
Yeah.
I think there's all sorts of potential solutions and all sorts of issues that need to be tackled. And it's hard. All of them are hard.
Yeah. But you're onto that with trust and transparency.
I think so. I absolutely agree. And I think especially in, you know, first and foremost is safety, right? Safety and quality of your medications, which are so critical to your health. And look, the whole pharmaceutical industry has doubled the human lifespan. Like, they've done amazing things.
Right.
Which is great. We just have to make them right.
Right.
And really kind of fulfill what the generic industry was originally supposed to be, was an equivalent, you know, lower cost, you know, quality way to get all the benefits of the original discoveries.
Yeah. But it's human nature. There's always going to be either some purposely nefarious things going on, and some of it just cutting corners and cutting them too far.
Right. And I think, look, there's many layers to that problem. There's the problem that these bad actors out there, and a fair number of them, the fact that the system itself was engineered in a way that it's easy to cheat.
Yeah.
If it was a system that didn't enable so many cracks, then we'd have fewer of them, most likely.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot kind of institutionally that should change.
Right.
Things like this disillusion that you could use drain cleaner.
Exactly.
Why is that? That doesn't make any sense.
That doesn't make sense.
And that takes some fundamental change. And I think first and foremost, it takes, the humility to say that there are problems.
Yeah, right.
Right? The system isn't perfect.
No.
I think, regulators and industry as a whole are working towards the best possible products and systems, on average, and that's great, but it's not perfect.
Yeah.
And it's far from it. And we have to admit that there are these problems, and now let's start fixing it and working with industry, with independent, testing and that ability to have real transparency and real quality assurance.
Yeah.
Infuse that to patients is like, I can't imagine anything more important than that.
Yeah.
Now, of course, pricing is important.
Right.
And there's all sorts of important things and, what PBMs do and restricting choice and all these kinds of things and clawbacks and a lot of problems out there, but safety first.
Yeah.
Safety first. Quality of your healthcare, and nothing more important than that.
Yeah. I like what you said there. You said that the legislatures or regulators are moving forward and want the best for people on average. I think you said that. Was that right?
Right.
So you got some bad eggs in there, but on average, it's in the right direction.
Yeah. And look, and especially when you read a book like Bottle of Lies and you get into a lot of the details of the really bad actors.
Yeah.
But
on average.
Yeah. So not everybody's like that, but some are.
David, favorite part of your week, business-wise?
Hearing from the patients that we affect.
Mm. Good.
We're more and more, hearing from patients, from doctors.
Yeah.
Thank you for creating this company. How can I help?
That feedback.
Yeah, exactly. Seeing that feedback, like, hey, I was on this drug for a long time and had all these problems, and now everything is more consistent with my symptoms, and I'm just really happy that you guys exist. And a lot of
That's
just
cool.
just happy that somebody's actually checking. It's very rewarding to get that. And for me, that's back to your original question of what excited me as a kid was sciences and all that.
Yeah.
But the entrepreneurship, in addition to the science, where you can actually take these really cool, neat things, like I love laboratories spectrometry and solving scientific problems is awesome. But being able to impact people's lives and improve them and make a difference is very exciting.
Yeah, that's so cool. So many of us kids, learned especially the chemistry and stuff in the books, and you'd see some experiments, and mixed vinegar and baking soda and those kind of things. But it's cool to really, I'm sure it's really cool for you to be able to see things happen and then also, like you say, in people. David, finally, what would you do if somebody came in right now and said, you got to leave for 3 months and no science, you can't do any science, you can't do anything with the business, you're kind of like on a 3 month sabbatical? How would you spend that time, basically?
I'd definitely catch up on surfing in San Diego.
Surfing in San Diego.
Yeah, yeah. Take the whole family down. I grew up in San Diego.
Where are you now?
In Yale Science Park in New Haven, Connecticut is where Valisher is, and I live in the area.
Okay. Is that due mainly to your schooling, or is there a reason to be out there in this kind of a molecular market?
Yeah, no, I came out here for school, and you know, there's just a tremendous amount of biotech opportunities here, and was working here, and kind of grew the roots. And my wife is a native of the area, and and all her siblings, and you know how it goes with putting down roots. And Connecticut's a great place, but
it's not San Diego.
San Diego's hard to compete with. Yeah,
you'd go surfing in San Diego.
Yeah, I used to surf a lot. Obviously not very good surf in the Long Island Sound. So I do a lot of kayaking out here.
Why is the surf bigger on the West Coast versus East Coast? I think that's across the board pretty much, right?
Well, so it really depends on just where you are on the East Coast. There are some surf spots that are okay. I mean, you know, Connecticut's got Long Island in front of it, so there's really almost no surf.
Gotcha. Down south, there's surf and so on.
And the Pacific is pretty good. And there's particularly good beaches in San Diego. I was born in Israel, and when I was three, to San Diego.
Were your parents, did they start as U.S. citizens, or are they from Israel?
They became citizens, yeah. So they're Israeli citizens, and then they became citizens of the United States.
It's not like they were there for the service or anything. They were actually from Israel originally.
Born and raised in Israel, came here when I was 3 years old. And the point is that I was, my original name when I was born was Yam, which means ocean.
No kidding.
And so I've always had a strong, you know, connection on many levels to the water and the ocean. And I was a very avid surfer when I was in San Diego and kayaker. And, you know, I still live very close to the beach in Connecticut and do a lot of kayaking and, you know, swimming and those kind of things.
Are the waves big enough in San Diego? Are you always thinking, I wish I was in, you know, Hawaii or something? Or are you satisfied with the waves in San Diego?
I'm perfectly satisfied with San Diego.
They don't have to be, sometimes they're too big for you?
I enjoy you get a storm out there, and we would go in storms here and there, and you get some pretty big waves. I'm not a professional surfer of any, by any means. Perfectly happy with San Diego.
I always picture myself like in Lake Michigan, and I'd be riding these waves like on my tummy board or something like that. And I would always think it looks so cool. But if someone took a picture of me, it'd be like when I play football with my brothers, we have our annual Turkey Bowl coming up in a couple days. And I might like jump for a pass, and I'm picturing myself like looking like I'm in a full out spread like the pros, and I'm probably a half inch off the ground, but in my mind, I'm doing that. So that's how I pictured myself surfing, but you've got some real waves out there. That'd be really cool.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a great place.
Wait, so do you get out there and do that occasionally then?
Here and there. Yeah, when I can find an excuse to get out there. You know, when there's a conference out in San Diego, that tends to get high priority on my calendar. Yeah.
My son now, who's like 16, one of my sons, but he was like 7, he's in the backseat of the car, and he said, Dad, when you die, can you go anywhere? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, anywhere? I'm like, yeah. And I'm picturing like he's on this, you know, moonbeam going to Saturn or something like that. Yeah. He says, all right, I'm going to Florida.
Well, you know, they got these planes these days.
So San Diego is pretty close to that. But all right, David, pleasure to meet you. I'll be watching closely.
Thank you. No, thank you very much for having me.
I was sitting around, and I saw this on my phone going through LinkedIn, and I sent off an email to you right away because it was a really something that grabbed my attention, and I think it's going to grab everybody's attention strongly. You guys are going to do great things.
No, thank you very much, and totally agree. You know, these are real problems that we're addressing, I think, in a very serious way, and we're very interested in interacting with the pharmacy community, you know, the healthcare systems as a whole, because I think this is just, you know, so important for patients, right? That's all of our focus in healthcare. So thanks again for the opportunity to go into the story. Great to continue these conversations.
My pleasure. Yeah, I look forward to keeping in touch.
Absolutely. Thanks again.
All right. Thanks, David.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.